We're going to begin talking about question 125 tonight. The Larger Catechism at this point addresses a couple of questions that are not found in the Shorter Catechism. The Larger Catechism has a number of more refined discussions, and this is one of them. This is designed to make you think about the term father and mother in the fifth commandment. And to a large extent, the reason this is here, the reason they are asking you to consider the terminology, is because traditionally, honor thy father and mother, the fifth commandment, has been viewed as having ramifications for all levels of social order. And last time we talked about the really the duties that inferiors have. There's a lot of focus on that. This portion is going to refocus attention on the duties of superiors. We're going to deal with superiors, inferiors, and equals as separate questions, separate propositions, and we'll deal with the duties and the omission, sins of omission that pertain to each station in due course. But this styling of superiors as father and mother in the commandment, the fact that they're all in some sense encompassed under this, these titles, has bearing on how we should approach not only the obedience of this commandment as inferiors, but it also ought to evoke a perspective and a concern in superiors for inferiors. If you understand that these terms really apply to all superiors in your life, then you'll understand why it is so important that these are the very terms that have been picked. The commandment does not say honor thy superiors. It very easily could have said honor thy superiors. By placing the name father and mother in there, the point the point of the catechism calling attention to this is, in fact, to point up there is a natural relation, which we're going to talk about, that is implied in this. We tend to think of relations with people outside of family as being perhaps somehow not quite as genuine. Most people adhere to this idea that blood is thicker than water, that is, that kinship is more important than what you believe, than what you're professing. If we understand the fifth commandment, there is implied in this a certain notion of kinship. There's a certain notion of interrelatedness in civil order. This idea comes up sometimes when you hear people talking about things like the human family, or when a national leader says, when there's some crisis, we're going to have a family discussion about this matter. We're going to have a national dialogue, and they were sometimes we'll refer to it as a family discussion. It's recognized by most people in most countries that there is this familial tie. It's a little bit harder to see in this country in particular because it's been further removed. But I think when we consider the nature of this command and if we consider what's behind it, it isn't really, it shouldn't really strike you as some unnatural imposition. In fact, it ought to strike you as not only natural but reasonable that God is styling all superiors in this way. And so that's what I hope that you'll understand as we go through, that this styling them this way is really meant for your benefit as well as for the benefit of superiors. And question 125, then, why are superiors styled father and mother? The answer is that superiors are styled father and mother, both to teach them in all duties toward their inferiors, like natural parents, to express love and tenderness to them according to their several relations, and to work inferiors to a greater willingness and cheerfulness in performing their duties to their superiors as to their parents. So, first of all, we see that the Catechism is instructing us to view this command as enjoining us to view our civil relations in more intimate terms. And there's a reason for this. Generally, when you begin to view other people that way, you begin to focus on shared interest, shared experience, shared life in whatever aspect that portion of the ordering of your life is transpiring. So, we want to ask, first of all, what is the significance of styling superiors by the name of father and mother? And the answer is, first of all, calling superiors by the name of father and mother is to draw them to a willing fulfilling of all their duties towards inferiors. Look at Matthew 7, 9 to 11.
Matthew 7, verse 9 through 11. Or what man is there of you whom if his son ask bread, will he give him a stone? Or if he ask a fish, will he give him a serpent? If ye then, being evil, know how to give good gifts unto your children, how much more shall your Father, which is in heaven, give good things to them that ask him?
The fact is, God defends his goodness, or Christ defends the goodness of God, against the backdrop of a presumption that parents generally intend or have a good intention in what they do for children, particularly when children ask them to do something. There's a certain presumption there that when you ask your parents, they're not going to deliberately try to subvert your entire life and ruin you. And so when you learn to look at superiors in whatever station in this way, you should learn to look at them as we're being instructed to look to God, not full of suspicion and doubt and fear, but with an assumption that they're going to behave in a certain way. When you look at your superiors in that way, you actually are calling on them to do their duty to you. You're reminding them of the obligation they have as your superior in whatever station they occupy. It's important that in that relationship that you confirm in your superior that, in fact, you recognize they are in that realm your superior. There's nothing wrong with it. God has put them in that position. God has put you in the position you're in. And if there's a concern that your superior is forgetting their station in life, the best way to get them to remember that, to remind them, is to make that kind of appeal. Father and mother are the kind of terms of appeal that summon up in everyone, because of the way we're created, they summon up in everyone this reservoir of natural affection. All right. Superiors are, in fact, to occupy their respective stations and exercise their gifts on behalf of others, especially on behalf of inferiors. Look at Romans 15, 1.
Romans 15, verse 1. We then that are strong ought to bear the infirmities of the weak, and not to please ourselves.
The strong are to bear the infirmities of the weak. That's not the law of the jungle. That's the rule of the gospel. That's the rule of true religion. Now, social Darwinism is about the strong running roughshod over the weak. True religion is telling the strong that they are to bear the weak. They've been given whatever strength they've been given. They've been given whatever gift they've been given. They've been given whatever station of superiority they've been given. Not so that they can consume it upon themselves, but so that they can bear with the infirmities of others. One thing that makes you the inferior in any relation is your infirmity with respect to that relation. You are, if you're the inferior, you are the weaker vessel. You are the weaker link. Not everyone is as important at a national level as national leaders, or at a state level as state leaders. There are degrees. There are levels of superiority and inferiority. But superiors have this duty, which we're going to talk about in time, in a few weeks. We'll begin talking about this. Superiors have peculiar duties. And if they fail to do them, they'll be held accountable to God. It's not, generally speaking, it's not the duty of inferiors to try to hold their superiors to account. Right. The fact is that this idea that they're to occupy and exercise their gifts on behalf of others, we see in Job. Job, in his prosperity, was called a common father to all who were under him. Look at Job 29, 11, and 16.
Job 29, verses 11 and 16, verse 11. When the ear heard me, then it blessed me, and when the eye saw me, it gave witness to me. And verse 16. I was a father to the poor, and the cause which I knew not, I searched out.
Job says he was a father to the poor. He was a judge over those who were under him. He was a patriarchal figure in the land of Uz. Job was a person of high regard. You can tell that just when you read about his friends coming to sit with him. They held him in great esteem, and their You know, part of their dilemma is they're in great confusion too, because someone that they held in such great esteem, someone that they looked up to, appears to have fallen greatly by virtue of being hammered in the providence of God. But Job was a common father to them, and he exercised his power and his judgment on their behalf, not against them, not contrary to them, not in a way that would in any way impede them. He used what he had to enrich them and to bring a sense of justice to their lives. And when he's responding to them, he's reminding them of that here in Job 29. And remember, I'm the guy, I know you think I maybe did all these horrible things and this is why this came upon me, but I'm the guy who, when you were down and out, I'm the guy who helped you. When a lot of people wouldn't. Job reached out. He didn't view what he had as his in some absolute sense. He viewed it as his in stewardship. And that's what superiors are to do. Right? Styling them by these names ought to recall the fundamental natural relations existing between all men. Look at Genesis 30, verse 2, or verse 20.
Genesis 3, verse 20. Adam called his wife's name Eve. She was the mother of all living.
Adam called his wife's name Eve. She's the mother of all living. There is a fundamental connection that all men have. Paul relates that God made all nations of one blood. There's this natural relation that exists between all men. And so by using these terms, we're reminding both ourselves and others, as we think in these terms and address people with these terms in mind, we're reminding ourselves and others of that relation. And the thing about it is this: common nature, we know, ought to beget common sympathy. Look at Hebrews 2, 14 to 18.
Hebrews chapter 2. Verses 14 through 18. Forasmuch then as the children are partakers of flesh and blood, he also himself likewise took part of the same, that through death he might destroy him that hath the power of death, that is, the devil, and deliver them who through fear of death were all their lifetime subject to bondage. For verily he took not on him the nature of angels, but he took on him the seed of Abraham. Wherefore, in all things, it behooved him to be made like unto his brethren, that he might be a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God, to make reconciliation for the sins of the people. For in that he himself hath suffered, bearing, being tempted, he is able to succor them that are tempted.
The apostle tells us that one reason Christ can so sympathize with those for whom he died is that he took upon himself not the nature of angels, but of man, of Abraham, the seed of Abraham. He took upon himself a common nature.
Actually, it's kind of interesting. This is now twice in 1 week I've heard this. In one of Rutherford's letters, he says to, he's writing, somebody's infant and died, and he said, remember, Jesus was an infant so that he may share that burden with you. It was something like that. I never even thought about that idea that's why he became.
Yeah, it begets a common sympathy. He has a point at which he he can say, I not only know from the outside looking in that you're pained in this way, but I know because I've been pained in this way. When you style men by these names, when you think in terms of father and mother, there's a recalling of this common nature. And recalling that common nature is of the nature and tendency to beget a common sympathy. When inferiors treat superiors in terms of father and mother, they evoke from their superiors a fatherly and motherly disposition. And when superiors respond in that way, that actually these two positions feed on each other. It more inclines them to exercise that kind of affection, that natural affection, to find and exercise that common sympathy. That's what children do all the time with their parents. One reason you tend to sympathize most with your children, people put up with more stupid stuff from their children than they would ever put up with from somebody else's kids. People tend to be more patient and forbearing with their own children. I'm not talking about a temporary situation. A lot of people that you think you like and you think would like you, if they had to live with you 24/7, probably wouldn't find themselves too fond of you, and you wouldn't find yourself very fond of them either. But common nature, and when you're talking about that relation between parents and children, is very close. Common nature begets common sympathy. So in all of our relations in life, the more we play upon this, the more we will either provoke our inferior to that filial obedience or evoke from the superior that kind of paternal affection. Right. The fact is this: all men by nature face a common existence with its difficulties and fears. Look at Ecclesiastes 9:2.
Ecclesiastes 9, verse 2. All things come alike to all. There is one end to the righteous and to the wicked, to the good and to the clean, and to the unclean, to him that sacrificeth, to him that sacrificeth not. As is the good, so is the sinner.
The fact is that all men face the same kinds of difficulties. It doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter what you are, what you do, what your gifts are, what your talents are, what your position is. You could be the highest ranking general in the world. You could be the lowest ranking slave in the third world. You could be anything in between. And the fact is, everyone ultimately is faced with a number of similar uncertainties and difficulties. Ecclesiastes points to the fact of death. It doesn't matter who you are. Look at Job. This is one of the reasons people began to wonder about him. His entire family is literally wiped out overnight, with the exception of his wife. It doesn't matter who he is. It doesn't matter what his position is. He can't undo that. He can't keep that at bay. All men face these kinds of things. And all men face the difficulties that are inherent in living life on a sin-cursed planet. They face these difficulties daily. Some, it's more front and center than others. But at some point, everyone has to face it. You get old, if you live long enough. You get sick, if you live long enough, and you die. And you don't have to live long for that. That underscores everything. We live in a world with scarceness. You don't have everything you want. Doesn't matter how much you have. I have yet to meet anyone who has any amount, whether it's money, power, prestige, whatever, nobody's satisfied with what they have. They all want more, and they want to be more secure in that. Doesn't matter. Everybody recognizes that there are difficulties. Everybody is plagued with fears about these things. So, we not only share a common nature, we share a common environment. We share a common course in life. Father and mother are terms and thoughts and categories in which to organize our thinking about these relations that bring all of this into closer observation and contemplation in our lives. We can begin to observe in people. This common nature. And we can begin, in fact, to behave in such a way that there is an expression of common sympathy. It doesn't matter who you are, whether you're superior, inferior, equal. You're going to face the same things at different times in life, perhaps in different ways, but they're the same kinds of fears and difficulties. All right. The fact is that, furthermore, like Mordecai, all superiors should seek opportunities to exercise their positions in a paternal fashion, exhibiting natural affection. Look at Esther 2:7 and Genesis 48:5.
Esther 2:7. And he brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter. For she had neither father nor mother, and the maid was fair and beautiful, whom Mordecai, when her father and mother were dead, took for his own daughter.
Genesis 48, verse 5. And now thy two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, which were born unto thee in the land of Egypt before I came unto thee into Egypt, are mine. As Reuben and Simeon, they shall be mine.
The fact is, the Bible gives us a number of examples of this, where the superiors move into positions. We'll talk about more of those in a moment, but they move into positions where they occupy what in law we would refer to as in loco parentis, in the place of parents. They function in a parental fashion, whether it's with regard to family, church, or state. Superiors, in fact, are commanded, and we will talk about this, but they're commanded to seek opportunities. They should be looking for ways to behave in this kind of fashion, to take people under their wings, to help them, to bring redress to people's lives. Job did this. God commands, Paul commands us that the stronger should help the weaker. There's this idea of looking out, seeking out, searching out opportunity. You don't have a right, if you're superior in any relation, to retain whatever it is you are superior about. Whatever that is, it makes you a superior. You don't have a right to engross that and hold that and keep that to yourself. You just simply don't have that right. You're to search out every opportunity to use whatever it is that makes you a superior for the benefit of an inferior. And that is an assertion of natural affection. Right? It is ennobling, in fact, for superiors to exercise humility in the face of their inferiors. Look at Philippians 2:5-9 and Hebrews 1:4.
Philippians 2:5-9. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus, who, being in the form of God, thought it not robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation, and took upon him the form of a servant, and was made in the likeness of man. And being found in fashion as a man, he humbled himself, and became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. Wherefore, God also hath highly exalted him, and given him a name which is above every name.
Hebrews 1:4, being made so much better than the angels, as he hath by inheritance obtained a more excellent name than they.
If you're an inferior and you evoke this kind of paternal affection in a superior, you're actually helping ennoble your superior. We're going to talk about that again in a moment. But you're helping, and hopefully we'll get into why a little bit. You're helping them because when your superior exercises whatever talent, gift, position, etc., on your behalf, that is an act of humiliation. They're humbling themselves to do that for you. And that is ennobling. That's the point of the humiliation of Christ. His exaltation follows his humiliation. He doesn't begin exalted. He begins in humiliation. He's raised through the humiliation to exaltation. Was he or was he not the superior? Isn't he the superior of every man who ever lived? And yet he became the servant of all. But in becoming the servant of all, he didn't put aside his position of superiority. He didn't cease to be Lord. He humbled himself and exercised all of that power, all of that prestige, all of that position, all of those gifts on behalf of inferiors for the benefit. That's why it's so important for superiors to be responsive in this way. God himself behaves toward man in this way. We'll see later when we talk about inferiors, it has a reciprocal effect. Right, that leads us to the second question, which is this: what should this teach them? What is it that the terms father and mother should teach to superiors? The answer is, it should teach them the need to perform all duties towards inferiors with that kind of love and tenderness becoming parents. Look at Colossians 3:21.
Colossians 3, verse 21. Fathers, provoke not your children to anger, lest they be discouraged.
Father and mother, styling should. When people think in these terms, it should remind superiors that they have a duty to behave toward their inferiors in this kind of way. That they should exercise this kind of love and tenderness that Jesus talked about in that verse we read from Matthew 7. Fathers, parents, don't give their children snakes and scorpions or rocks when they ask for bread. It's just not what they do. Parents don't behave in that way. When we hear stories about parents doing horrible things to their children, one thing that makes it a monstrosity and catches so many people's attention above other types of stories, when you hear about mothers who strangle their children or whatever, one reason it catches your attention so much and becomes such a buzz is it's so contrary to nature. And it's particularly contrary to the nature of parents. If superiors think in terms of this commandment in all of their relations in life, wherein they find themselves as superiors, they would behave themselves in a way that is much more refined and reflective of that kind of paternal affection. Right? And the reason why this is first of all, and I already mentioned this a little bit, parents share the same nature as their children in closer familial interest in matters of, or excuse me, in closer familial affinity, which should be get a deeper sympathy. Look at Psalm 103:13.
Psalm 103:13. Like as a father pitieth his children, so the Lord pitieth them that fear him.
Fathers ultimately pity children. If somebody else came to you with a piece of paper scribbled up with crayon and said, look at this, unless you ran the Museum of Modern Art, you probably would say, throw it away, you've ruined another sheet of paper. Waste of time. When children do that, parents have that kind of common sympathy for them. And it's a sympathy that is magnified by this close familial affinity. It draws them to behave in a way that is kind and affectionate. In the very kind of things that you wouldn't probably normally be inclined. The reason is this close familial affinity. This happens all the time. You don't find the problems of your own as offensive as the problems that other people have. Familial affinity is the root of that. You know, if in fact there wasn't that underlying familial affinity, it would make it very, very difficult for anybody to live together in close mutual harmony. Right. The second thing is it also leads to deeper interest in matters of discipline. Look at Proverbs 3:12.
Proverbs 3:12. For whom the Lord loveth, he correcteth, even as a father, the son in whom he delighteth.
The fact is that a fatherly disposition, a parental affection, actually begets discipline. If people wonder why, and I've heard it from numerous individuals over the years, why their parents or their siblings are the most critical of them, of anybody in the world. Nobody else views them that way. It's actually a matter of familial affection, that familial affinity. The reason why most people don't criticize you is they don't care about you. The reason why they don't challenge you or push you is they don't have that kind of interest to see you move along or go beyond where you are. The Bible is very clear, in fact, that superiors which fail to administer chastisement in due course fail to behave as parents. Look at Hebrews 12:7-8.
If ye endure chastening, God dealeth with you as with the Son, but with the Son is he whom the Father chasteneth not. But if ye be without chastisement, whereof all are partakers, then are ye bastards and not sons.
Again, Paul says what? That if God chastises you, it's because you're a son. Who doesn't get chastised? Bastards. People who've been abandoned by their parents don't receive parental discipline. Parental affection manifests itself. Parental affection, in fact, one part of it is borne out in this idea of chastening, correcting. It's the job of parents to tell their kids they don't like what they're doing, they don't like how they're acting, they don't like how they're dressing, they don't like how they're behaving at this event or how they're performing at that event or fill in the blank. And children today, in particular, more than ever, complain about this because they don't honor their father and mother. But this is part of familial duty, if you will. And it's begotten of this affinity, which is rooted in a very deep and abiding sympathy. And not only do parents put up with stupid things that kids do, their own children do more than they would a lot of times with others. A lot of times other kids you would have already had thrown in jail and executed. But they're also, in on the other side, they're more inclined to scrutinize and criticize and comment on. All right, the third thing that we should note here is that they should instruct their inferiors to help them perceive that their own welfare and security is to be found in a way of obedience. Look at Proverbs 4:1-4.
Proverbs 4:1-4. Hear, the children, the instruction of a father, and attend to no understanding. For I give you good doctrine, forsake ye not my law. For I was my father's son, tender and only beloved in the sight of my mother. He taught me also and said unto me, let thine heart retain my words, keep my commandments, and live.
Okay, so what is it Solomon is saying? He's saying, as a superior to the inferiors, listen. obedience is the way of life. Your welfare and your security in life throughout your life is dependent upon and shall be dependent upon how well you follow this command. To the extent that you disobey this command, it's going to follow you forever. The whole idea, and we're going to talk about this more when we talk about the promise annexed, but the promise annexed carries with it an idea of prospering in your maturity. It helps to understand, and this is one reason we've talked about this, why God tells us to obey. He gives us promises. He annexes promises. He has threatenings. Why? To let us know the ins and outs and the ups and downs and the pluses and minuses of obedience. Right? We need to make sure that we perceive that our welfare and our security is tied up with that proper honoring of father and mother, and conversely, we need, as superiors, to convey that to our inferiors. The stability and the prosperity of all society, church and state, flow from the stability of familial society. When that breaks down, everything else goes. It's based upon this principle. Right? We're also told that disobedience brings with it God's curse and a bad conscience. Look at Proverbs 13:15. Good understanding is favor. Understand you're going to behave. When you don't understand, you're exhibiting the fact that you simply don't, that you're not inclined to behave correctly. A lack of understanding and disobedience go hand in hand, and they feed one another. Understanding and obedience go hand in hand, and they feed one another. The former brings God's curse and a bad conscience. The latter, that brings God's blessing, and it allows you to have a good conscience. So it's important then that parents do their duty toward their children. But it's equally important that as superiors, all superiors behave in this fashion toward their inferiors. They have an obligation to sympathize, to correct them, and to really to try to get them to understand, instruct them in such a way that they learn and come to understand and appreciate that their welfare, now and in the future, depends on this. All right, the third question is, what are those several relations contemplated? when it talks about the several relations that are in view, there are a few that we know are pretty clear in Scripture. The first is there are natural relations, such as between parents and children. Look at Leviticus 19:3.
You shall fear every man his mother and his father and keep my Sabbaths. I am the Lord your God.
And of course, it's no surprise here that parental relations with your children and vice versa, that these relations are in view. We're talking about honor thy father and thy mother. Shouldn't be a surprise that that relation is in view. That's what we call a natural relation. And that also takes into account other types of natural relations. You know, we talked about Mordecai and even Jacob when he was talking about Joseph, Joseph's sons. He's a superior. Those are natural relations, but he's clearly exercising that office of superiority in a fashion, in both cases. They're in a fashion to exhibit that natural affection, treat those under them in such a fashion that what might be a more distant relation comes into immediate view. The grandparents tend to treat grandchildren, if possible, with more affection than their immediate children. And the reason, again, is that there is, in a sense, a reaching out and an attempt to tie with an expression of natural affection, to tie your grandchildren to you more, because, in fact, the familial affinity is a little bit more removed. So you're trying to overcompensate in some way. You want to tie that bond a little closer and tighter because it's important to you. It's not wrong for grandparents to behave in that way. It's natural. It is an expression of natural affection. And people do this in different relations. It's just an example. But these are natural relations. Sometimes this happens between, you'll see this happen between uncles and nephews, aunts and nieces. You'll see this in other ways, between brother and brother, or brother and sister, or sister and sister. You see these kinds of attempts to tie these natural affections even tighter, if possible. Right, so that's certainly, natural relations are one type of relation that we're going to have to talk about as we go through all of these and begin to detail. Second type of relation are political relations, such as between rulers and subjects. Look at Mark 11:10. Political relations, while they're not as near in affinity, nonetheless, we're going to have to talk about the relations between rulers and subjects. We're going to have to talk about what they entail when we talk about fathers and mothers. This is covered. David is viewed not only as a king, but he's a father. He's exercised his office in such a way that, in fact, we see this, and I've mentioned this before, we talk about city fathers or founding fathers when we talk about nations. Why? Well, because I think there's an implicit recognition that somehow the fifth commandment comes into play. Why is it that founders and people who endow colleges and people who do other great works for their nation, whether they're generals or politicians or humanitarians. They tend to have buildings named after them, statues erected, things like this. They're viewed in some sense as being people possessed of an extraordinary sense of parental affection. They've done something out of the ordinary, which most people, at least at one point in time, viewed as benefiting a lot of people. They put themselves out for the benefit of people. So we're going to have to talk about political relations here. This is one of the relations that they're talking about. Third kind of relation that we're going to have to talk about are contractual, or by covenantal agreement, such as between masters and servants. Look at Colossians 3:22.
Colossians 3:22, servants, in all things obey your masters according to the flesh, not with eye service as men pleasers, but in singleness of heart, fearing God.
These are not natural, nor are they political. These are voluntary, usually, not always. They are, in some sense, contracted. And these terms apply in those kinds of relations as well. All right. So, as we go through, the first relation pertains to families or actual parents, whose behavior requires both the resolve necessary to superiors, together with a sense of what is called noblesse oblige, which reflects that natural affection existing in the bosom of a parent. Ephesians 6:4.
Ephesians 6:4. And ye fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord.
Okay, so when we talk about the first kind of relations, those that are natural, there is, in fact, in natural relation is where this idea of noblesse oblige, that is, that nobility obliges. It is a noble thing to oblige oneself. That's what ennobles men, is when they oblige themselves as superiors to inferiors. That's what's ennobling, in fact, about superiors. Why did we used to refer to these people as being nobles? Because these were superiors who exercised their positions of power and talent on behalf of others. They exercised all of this in a parental fashion, with parental affection. And that's ennobling. That ennobles them. And people used to recognize that. All right? But that first place where that begins, the first place where most people begin to have that sense, is when they become parents. That you don't exist simply for yourself. That you have an obligation. Here are people who are absolutely, utterly dependent upon you. And if you don't exercise yourself on their behalf, they will literally die. They can't take care of themselves. And at first, they can't even feed themselves. That creates, there's a certain ennobling that occurs naturally just by virtue of becoming parents. And so when we talk about this natural relation, we should be thinking about this, that this natural affection in the bosom of a parent is that first movement. And that's exactly what we see in God. God created us, and He is moved to have mercy upon us, to pity us. We couldn't help ourselves. We should consider here as well that godly parents ought to be moved by consideration of eternal truths and consequences. Look at Proverbs 19:18.
Proverbs 19:18. Chasten thy son while there is hope, and let not thy soul spare for his crying.
When we have natural relations and there is true religion involved, this sense of noblesse oblige, part of what is ennobling is instilling in your children a sense of the true religion. We'll talk about that more as well. But again, that begins with this first relation, because all of these other relations couldn't come into existence without this first category of relations, natural relations. Without natural relations, you wouldn't have people to have political relations or contractual or covenantal relations. It just wouldn't happen. All right, a second relation, that is the rulers and subjects, pertains, for example, to those in the church by ecclesiastical office, by virtue of which they are superiors, and therefore they're as parents. Look at 2 Corinthians 12:14.
Second Corinthians 12:14. Behold, the third time I am ready to come to you, and I will not be burdensome to you. For I seek not yours, but you. For the children ought not to lay up for the parents, but the parents for the children.
What is it he's saying here? He's saying that there's an obligation. Parents have a first obligation to the children. If the children have an obligation to the parents, but their obligation to their parents is based upon, to a large extent, the fact that their parents have already extended themselves in ways that you can never repay. As we enter a culture where we have fewer and fewer people who are parents, there we enter a culture that is less ennobled in general. The more children, the more ennobling it is, because it forces you out of yourself again and again and again. The more you help other people when you're the superior in any relation, the more ennobling it is, because again, you're forcing yourself out. It's voluntary, usually, but you force yourself out of that position of superiority to use whatever it is that made you the superior on behalf of others. It begins in the natural realm, but it also occurs in this political realm, which is shared by the church. The church actually, you know, we talk about church government, and there's a reality to this. You know, the fact is, when we talk about church officers, they are your superiors. They're superiors. In that relation, you could have the President of the United States or the King of, or I should say the Queen of England, in that congregation, and the ministers and elders in that relation would be their superiors. Wouldn't matter who they are in terms of civil government. In terms of church government, they're no longer the superiors. So we'll talk about that more, but your position can change in different relations. Some relations, you're the dependent. Some, you have an opportunity to ennoble. to be ennobled. Right? Thus then, when ministers, who in some respects are superior in office to others, mix their reproofs with tenderness and compassion towards the souls of men under their care, they're accounted as nurses. Look at 2 Thessalonians 2, 7 and 8.
2 Thessalonians 2, verses 7 and 8. For the mystery of iniquity doth already work. Only he who now letteth will let until he be taken out of the way. And then shall that wicked be revealed, whom the Lord shall consume with the spirit of his mouth, and shall destroy with the brightness of his coming.
1 Thessalonians 2, 7 and 8.
1 Thessalonians 2, verses 7 and 8. But we were gentle among you, even as a nurse cherisheth her children. So being affectionately desirous of you, we were willing to have imparted unto you not the gospel of God only, but also our own souls, because you were dear unto us.
The apostle says that he performed his duty as a nurse. It's a motherly term. It's parental affection involved. He's addressing them with that kind of tenderness. In other words, he's saying he recognizes that as a superior in this position, that he is required to deal with them tenderly, mercifully. He is to, in fact, deal with them in such a way that they are aware that his reproofs, his criticisms, his corrections are being brought to them not for their destruction, but for their welfare. Not in order simply to tear them down and destroy them, but to build them up, to nourish them, to cause them to grow up in grace and truth. And just like parents are doing things to their children, they're required sometimes to use the rod, they're required to bring reproof, they're required to bring correction. Is it to destroy the child? No, it's because correction at the end of the day, if it's received and rightly improved, it will help the child throughout his or her life. That's why then the apostle acknowledges the authority as parental in nature. 1 Thessalonians 2:11.
First Thessalonians 2:11, as ye know how we are exhorted and comforted and charged every one of you as a father doth his children.
Yeah, Paul finally moves from accounting what he's doing as being like a nurse to as a father does to his children. He recognizes in that parental authority, or parental, I should say, affection. It's the authority is parental in nature. And he exercises it with that proper reference. In other words, Paul is exercising that authority with the fifth commandment in mind. He recognizes that. Right, faithful ministers function analogously in the spiritual birth of those over whom they command respect. Look at
Galatians 4:19.
My little children, of whom I travail and birth until Christ be formed in you.
And Paul talks about what ministers are doing. Why are they your superiors? Why is it that people in church office would be your superiors? Well, spiritually speaking, what they're doing is parental. They're begetting you in the faith. The second relation also pertains to those in civil authority, magistrates. properly speaking, magistrates should have a close connection to a people. In order to have a close connection to a people, it ought to be parental in nature. There, we want to look at Numbers 11, 11 and 12.
Numbers 11, 11 and 12. And Moses said unto the Lord, wherefore hast thou afflicted thy servant? And wherefore have I not found favor in thy sight? Thou layest the burden of all this people upon me. Have I conceived all this people? Have I begotten them, that thou shouldest say unto me, carry them in thy bosom, as a nursing father beareth the suckling child, of the land which thou swearest unto their fathers?
Magistrates ought to approach people. It's their duty to approach with this same kind of disposition, this parental disposition. The difference between a tyrant and a magistrate, in some respect, has to do with this parental affection, this parental, this exercise of authority with this parental affection, with a recognition that they have an obligation to exercise their power, their prestige, on behalf of those who don't have that power or prestige. They need to consider the people in that fashion. And that's, in fact, why we're told that magistrates which study most the highest interest of a people are, in fact, fulfilling their office as superiors worthy of parental respect. Look at Isaiah 49:23.
And kings shall be thy nursing fathers, and their queens thy nursing mothers. They shall bow down to thee with their face to the earth, and lick up the dust of thy feet. And thou shalt know that I am the Lord, for they shall not be ashamed that wait for me.
What is it that makes parents most worthy of the honor of their children? When they teach them, instruct them, bring them up in the true religion. That's the thing that they ought most to honor about their parents. And the same can be said not only of the church, where you would hope and expect it, but in among civil magistrates. Civil magistrates who are most concerned about the true religion and its effects in and through a society are most worthy of being accounted as nursing fathers and mothers. That is, they're the ones, in fact, who are exercising that authority in the most parental fashion. Why should there be a national establishment of religion? For the same reason that parents ought to teach their children the true faith. It is the most ennobling to put yourself out most for what is best for your inferiors. What is best is their spiritual good. All right, a third relation pertains to those who enter into any contractually or covenantally based relation. Look at Ephesians 5, 22 and 23.
Ephesians 5, verses 22 and 23. Wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands as unto the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, and he is the Savior of the body.
His third kind of relation is one that's based not in nature, not in some political scheme, but in a voluntary exchange. Sometimes it's between equals, sometimes there's a superior and inferior. But the fact is that it creates this relation where this commandment automatically comes into play. So we have to begin to consider it. In marriage, you have a covenantal, contractual relation. And that brings about a status where one person, by virtue of that, becomes a superior and the other becomes the inferior, period. The same includes matters of business or economic endeavor. Look at Hosea 10:4.
Hosea 10:4. They have spoken words, swearing falsely and making a covenant. Thus judgment springeth up as an hemlock in the furrows of the field.
Right. The fact is, again, then, this should, this relation, these relations that we're talking about really encompass everything that is going on in your life. All of your relations are going to be that is superior, inferior, equal. They're also all going to be somehow tied into natural relations, political relations, or contractual or covenantal relations. So you need to think about that as well. And we'll talk about those when we start going through the sins and the duties. Right? The last question that we really want to look at briefly is, what should this work in inferiors? We talked about, you know, what this should evoke in superiors is this kind of tenderness, of affection toward your inferiors, a desire to correct them, a desire to improve them, a desire to help them, a desire to do what is best for them. But if you're the inferior, what should these words be making you think about? Well, the titles ought to work in all inferiors, in fact, a twofold sense regarding duty. The first is this. It should instill in them a willingness to yield the due obedience as a proper register of the honor and esteem in which they are to hold their superiors. Look at 1 Corinthians 4:14-16.
1 Corinthians 4:14-16. I write not these things to shame you, but as my beloved sons I warn you. For though ye have 10,000 instructors in Christ, yet have ye not many fathers. For in Christ Jesus I have begotten you through the gospel. Wherefore I beseech ye, be ye followers of me.
If Paul appeals to this parental or superior status, and he says, therefore you should follow me. Do what I'm telling you to do. Right? If you understand what it means to call someone father or mother, if you understand what it means to be the inferior in that relationship, the first thing you need to do is be willing to yield due obedience. If you don't, you're not registering honor and esteem, which is due. If you don't, you're failing that very first word in the command, which is honor. A willingness is the response of reasonable creatures who are humble enough to accept their estate in life. Look at Philippians 2:3.
Philippians 2:3. Let nothing be done through strife or vainglory, but in lowliness of mind let each esteem other better than themselves.
Willingness is what God wants us to be. He wants us to be willing. He wants us to express a willingness in serving Him. Why? If you really understand who you are and what you are, it's the least that you can do. If you've done all that you can do, you're still an unprofitable servant. And that should inform inferiors in every relation. Why should you willingly obey? Willingly honor? Because by doing that, you're acknowledging your state in life.
So that's part of glorifying God then is
yes.
Nobling him. Or he is ennobled by our obedience.
He is ennobled by his humiliation.
Right.
His condescension. For God so loved the world. He gave his only begotten Son. That is the way that Christ is exalted, is he is ennobled by that humiliation. And that is how we are ennobled as well as superiors. But there is ennobling when your inferiors respond with a willing obedience. We glorify God when we do what he wants us to do willingly. So willingness is a response of reasonable creatures as well as those who receive in keeping of the law. There's great reward. Look at Isaiah 57, 20 and 21.
Isaiah 57, verses 20 and 21. But the wicked are like the troubled sea when it cannot rest, whose waters cast up mire and dirt. There is no peace, saith my God, to the wicked.
There's no peace to the wicked. There's no profit in what they do. The wicked, the lives of the wicked are characterized by a systematic violation of this command. They refuse to acknowledge their status. I mean, there's a sense in which all sin begins at this point, refusing to accept your place. Or the second thing that this should work in inferiors is it should evoke a cheerfulness in the yielding of obedience. Look at 2 Kings 5:13.
2 Kings 5:13. And his servants came there and spake unto him and said, my father, that the prophet had bid thee to do a great thing, wouldst thou not have done it? How much rather then that he said to thee, wash and be clean?
Yeah. If the prophet had bid Naaman do some great thing, his servant system, look, you would have done that. He's not asking you to do something great. He's saying, go down to Jordan and wash and be clean. In other words, if you understand, you came to the prophet, you wanted to know, he's your superior, you're the inferior. If he had given you some great thing to do, you wouldn't have even questioned it. You would have done it. The point is, there ought to be a cheerfulness in yielding obedience. There ought to be that kind of willingness and cheerfulness moving forward. You should be glad. He's not asking you to do a great thing, right? You should be happy with that. Why are you bucking at that? You understood what your superior really could demand of you and he's not doing it, you should really be happy. Why isn't he doing that? Fathers aren't to provoke their children to anger. God does not provoke us to sin. There ought to be a cheerfulness in yielding of obedience. Those who have a proper estimate of their status and relations recognize that simple obedience is the easiest and most profitable course for inferiors. Proverbs 3:17.
Her ways are ways of pleasantness, and all her paths are peace.
Her ways are ways of pleasantness. Why should it be cheerful obedience? Because obedience to the command is not a hard thing. Obedience to the command should not be this difficult, drawn-out proposition. It's pleasant. We're told it's pleasant. Now, those who struggle against this command of yielding cheerful obedience to the lawful commands of superiors are in fact accusing the Lord of lying. Look at 1 John 5:3.
1 John 5:3. For this is the love of God, that we keep His commandments, and His commandments are not grievous.
His commandments are not grievous. When we refuse to honor lawful commands of superiors, we're in essence accusing God of commanding us to do something that is too hard to be done. You know, when children kick up their heels and say, "Oh, I can't do this," they're really kicking against God. They're calling God a liar. You know, rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft. And that's what's behind all of this. This disregard. If you thought about your relations, and when you find yourself in a position of being an inferior, if you thought about these words, father and mother, it should instill in you a willingness and a cheerfulness. You should willingly obey. Why? Because you recognize who you are and what you are. You should cheerfully obey. Why? It always could be harder. It's not a difficult thing. In fact, if you would stop kicking against the pricks, you would find that there's a pleasantness in it. So, it's important then that we understand in these words, father and mother, that it should evoke one set of concerns when you're a superior. That is, it should inform your behavior toward inferiors. But likewise, if you find yourself in the role of inferior, it should be informing you how you ought to behave toward your superiors. And what both parties need to understand is that there's a mutual interest that they both have. You know, the inferior has an interest in obtaining the goodwill, the power, the prestige, the gifts, whatever it is the superior has. But remember, the superior, by being drawn out to yield this to the superior is ennobled. And that is great gain for the superior as well.
Stillwater's Revival Books is now located at PuritanDownloads.com. It's your worldwide online Reformation home for the very best in free and discounted classic and contemporary Puritan and Reformed books, MP3s, and videos. For much more information on the Puritans and Reformers, including the best free and discounted classic and contemporary books, MP3s, digital downloads, and videos, please visit Stillwater's Revival Books at PuritanDownloads.com. Stillwater's Revival Books also publishes the Puritan Hard Drive, the most powerful and practical Christian study tool ever produced. All thanks and glory be to the mercy, grace, and love of the Lord Jesus Christ for this remarkable and wonderful new Christian study tool. The Puritan Hard Drive contains over 12,500 of the best Reformation books, MP3s, and videos ever gathered onto one portable Christian study tool. An extraordinary collection of Puritan, Protestant, Calvinistic, Presbyterian, Covenanter, and Reformed Baptist resources. It's fully upgradable and it's small enough to fit in your pocket. The Puritan Hard Drive combines an embedded database containing many millions of records with the most amazing and extraordinary custom Christian search and research software ever created. The Puritan Hard Drive has been produced to assist you in the fascinating and exhilarating spiritual, intellectual, familial, ecclesiastical, and societal adventure that is living the Christian life. It has been specifically designed so that you might more faithfully know, serve, and love the Lord Jesus Christ, as well as to help you to do all you can to bring glory to His great name. If you want to love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, then the Puritan Hard Drive is for you. Visit PuritanDownloads.com today for much more information on the Puritan Hard Drive and to take advantage of all the free and discounted Reformation and Puritan books, MP3s, and videos that we offer at Stillwater's Revival Books.